We are not prepared to accept, though, this formulation at this time.
Thank you.
The frustration began to show.
If for some reason you are not willing to leave, leave it to the rest of us. Please get out of the way.
That was at the Bali conference in December, the place where humans failed to save their atmosphere. This is Radio EcoShock. We're going to do a tour of world media, getting reactions and feeling the pulse of propaganda. Hundreds of top scientists delivered their blunt warning, act now or lose the climate, where civilization arose. The head of the United Nations was pleading for concrete goals, starting soon. The European Union aligned with all of the developing nations, calling for mandatory cuts, 25% to 40% below 1990 levels by 2020. There sat the representatives of all the governments in agreement, except the dirty fews. Canada acted as the goon for George Bush in many opinions, with Japan and Russia hiding quietly behind. The rest of the world was ready to act. In this atmosphere of high theater on a heavenly tropical island of Bali, America appeared to bend, but did not. All the rest rushed in to grasp the appearance, the hope of further talks, the targets, the action to save the atmosphere, was dropped. We all lost. Scientists like James Lovelock and James Hansen, among thousands of others, have been clear. To our surprise, the climate is a delicate system. Even 1 degree of overall change can begin a chain of feedback loops that lead to a much hotter world. We have only a few years to drastically cut our emissions if we hope to limit this global warming to a level where our civilization can function. Now those years are being wasted in more rounds of talks. Perhaps we'll agree in 2012, the thinking goes, to institute changes that will start in 2030, just like the recent phony breakthrough in U.S. car mileage. Maybe our kids and grandchildren will do something about it. It's heartbreaking. Governments cannot adapt to new realities, and most humans still dream of fossil riches of giant cars and air conditioning. Let's see what we can find on the airwaves in these dark days before the storm. First up, United Nations Secretary Ban Ki-moon pleads for action at Bali.
We work for success. We don't work for failure. We must succeed from this Bali meeting. We must be able to launch negotiation with the time-bound negotiation for international agreement, hope by the end of 2009, with a clear agendas for present and future. We must be able to adopt this Bali roadmap. We have capacity in technology, finance, and science has made it quite clear. Only lacking is political will. I again urge the leaders to exercise their political will.
Next, we hear the UN's main climate man, a tired-looking Ivo de Boer, right after the conference ended.
In terms of the future, Bali has delivered what it needed to deliver, a very ambitious agenda going forward. I see it as transparent because a process that in the past was always a closed intergovernmental process is now opening up to the participation of business, civil society, international financial institutions, and the UN system to bring their expertise to this process over the coming year.
As the focus fell to the biggest polluter with the most resources to change to renewable energy, we find that the Bush administration gave up exactly nothing. Here is a spokesman for the American Enterprise Institute, a close ally and advisor to the Bush administration. He is Kenneth Green.
The U.S. actually carried the day in terms of getting its what its hard lines were. They did not want hard targets. They didn't get them. They did not want a commitment to a follow-on or to tighten up Kyoto, and they avoided that.
Even then, the White House backpedaled the very next day, as we hear from the BBC.
It took 13 days and a last-minute change of mind by the Americans to bring what the delegates thought was a successful resolution to the Bali Climate Conference. There was general agreement on a so-called roadmap to reduce carbon emissions. To the disappointment of the Europeans, there was no commitment on definite targets. Gordon Brown and Germany's Angela Merkel were among those happy that Bali was at least pointing the way forward. But no sooner were the delegates on the way home than the White House issued a statement saying it had serious concerns about what had been agreed. The principle signed up to in Bali was that developed countries should lead the way. But the White House statement said major developing countries should likewise act. That's believed to be a reference to countries like India and China. But the US accepted that smaller and poorer countries couldn't be expected to cut emissions so rapidly. Green groups have accused Washington of diluting the deal. The aid charity Oxfam called it a deep insult to the world's poorest people. Andy Moore, BBC News.
While we're listening to British reaction, let's go to the BBC December 16th, 2007. George Monbiot offers his opinion.
But there was no agreement in Bali on the level of mandatory CO2 cuts. Without that agreement, the world will continue to warm.
Without these binding mandatory targets, we can make all these vague expressions of goodwill and say what vaguely needs to be done, but nothing will actually happen. We have to say this is a level to which greenhouse gases must come down by a certain date.
The lack of coverage of the Bali Climate Conference in mainstream American media was stunning. You had to search through the usual political bump and the odd stories category to find any mention of the climate discussions. There was nothing on the main video page of ABC News, for example. CBS had a tiny feature on poor countries demanding green tech. My bet is most Americans remained unaware of this important venture or the result. Here's a bit from ABC News.
But with the Arctic ice receding by a dizzying pace, can the agreement, like so many before it, actually do anything to put the brakes on global warming? Here's ABC's Liz Morlantis.
We consider this to be an historical day.
Well, maybe. Delegates from 190 countries agreed to a roadmap for climate change. That's right, a roadmap, essentially agreeing that change could happen, but not until 2009.
It gives the world an opportunity, but not a guarantee, that we'll reach an agreement within 2 years that is up to the task of preventing dangerous global warming.
Think baby steps. Even getting this far has been a challenge.
We are not prepared to accept, though, this formulation at this time.
Thank you. Thank you, United States.
The Bush administration originally opposed the deal.
Leave it to the rest of us. Please get out of the way.
But eventually, in a rare shift, the U.S. backed down. It's the latest example of the pressure the White House is facing at home and abroad when it comes to global climate change.
The Arctic is experiencing faster melting.
Public awareness of the issue is up, way up, thanks to former Vice President / Nobel Peace Prize winner Al Gore. Still, it may all amount to very little.
In a statement, the White House said that while aspects of the Bali Agreement are positive, it still has, quote, serious concerns, and that for climate change to be adequately addressed, major developing countries, translation China and India, must commit to emissions cuts as well.
The hard part now, hammering out specifics. Of course, by then, the chief negotiator will no longer be George W. Bush, but his successor. For Good Morning America, Liz Marlantis, ABC News, Washington.
Australia, which has suffered terribly from climate-induced drought, had this to say.
Finally, the UN Climate Conference in Bali has its roadmap for an extension of the Kyoto Protocol. It's basically an agreement for more talks in 2009 to extend the treaty beyond 2012. But the breakthrough didn't come easily. Resentment swelled and tempers flared among the 190 international delegates before the United States made a key concession. Eventually, it was a much watered-down agreement.
The European Union told the floor it backs a compromise deal to help these talks move forward.
Thank you, Mr. President. Portugal, on behalf of the European Union, which is to tell you that we support the text you present to this plenary.
All week, the sticking point has been the United States' refusal to include targets of up to 40% emission cuts by 2020. But it's believed that text has been watered down. Talks then stalled and tempers flared as China took the floor.
And I would like to ask apologies from the Secretariat for repeating this. Thank you, Mr. President.
China is still negotiating its role in the final text, and until that's finalised, they called for the meeting to be suspended and a vote to be put on hold.
This meeting lays the groundwork for negotiations on a new climate deal when the Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012. Green groups want Australia to step up its role and commit to short-term global emissions targets and try and broker a stronger international agreement.
Well, we've ratified, but this meeting is not entirely gratifying. Australia's going to need to move into a leadership role in these international negotiations if in 2 years' time we can put our hands on our hearts and say we've done our best to stop dangerous climate change.
After a fortnight of intense and frustrating debate, the UN climate negotiator walked out in high emotion. Sarah Clark, ABC News, Bali.
Let's hear from the Greens, the Friends of Earth, speaking to the BBC.
I think that we would have a much different perspective to Hillary Benn. What we've seen happening this morning is that the countries have been forced to compromise to get the US to agree to a deal, basically.
Here's an excerpt from Stefan Schuritz of the European Greens and EFA after the conference.
Well, in fact, I see it on two layers. The first layer is if you really judge the result, the outcome, the basic outcome. There one has to state absolutely clear that it's far from what is necessary. If you see the scientific facts that are even worse than the IPCC predicts, and already the IPCC acknowledgements are really critical. So if you regard on the, or if you regard the scientific facts, one has to make absolutely clear that the outcome is far from what has been necessary. The second layer is, what is the underlying issue here? And it became apparent that it's, that there's no trust at all from the developing countries towards the, developed countries. And I think, this also became clear in the showdown now. The developing country deeply mistrust the developed country, and in particular the U.S., and I think this is by purpose.
In Canada, scientist and broadcaster David Suzuki spoke to the National Public Broadcaster, CBC.
That Canada, probably among all countries in the world, is as susceptible to climate change as any other country. We're a northern country. We know that the heating is going to go on much more, much greater towards the poles, and Inuit have been telling us that for years. We have the longest marine coastline of any country in the world. Just the expansion from warming of the ocean is going to flood our coastlines. And we still depend on agriculture, forestry, fisheries, tourism that are all climate sensitive. Canada is very vulnerable to the impact of climate change. So why isn't Canada up there beating the bushes and saying we need concrete targets and timelines? And what we get, at least the indications I've gotten from our performance at APEC in Sydney and the recent meetings of the Commonwealth in Africa, are that we're not serious about it at all. First of all, the rhetoric is, well, we've got to act on climate. Thank goodness our government is at least saying that. But we can't do anything that will jeopardize the economy. Wait a minute now. Our world is the air, water, and land where life exists. That can't grow anymore. It's fixed. Surely that ought to be setting our agenda. Not the economy. The economy doesn't come above that. And what is the government now proposing? Aspirational targets. What the hell is an aspirational target? The previous government said we'll have voluntary compliance. Seems to me it's the same thing. What it is, it says, oh, please, please, industry, please be good guys. Do your best, please. It doesn't work.
Canada, led by its Environment Minister John Baird, played the villain, threatening to kill off the possibility of a deal unless carbon emissions in China, India, and the poorer countries were cut in the same way. Let the poorest people live without electricity, says Canada, while we burn up the roads and leave our mansions well lit. Canada won an award as Fossil of the Day. The rest of the world hardly knows that Baird and the Conservatives are the party least liked by the majority of Canadians. Their minority opinion, their support of the Bush oil regime, does not represent anything like the public opinion polls back home. Here is Steve Gibault on CBC Radio.
Unfortunately, because of the consistent obstruction by Canada, the U.S. and Japan, where we could have had an historical agreement here in Bali, we have to go back home with a watered-down agreement.
In North America, the group at avaz.org, that's A-V-A-A-Z.org, organized a last-minute internet campaign to put pressure on governments. Of the 600,000 signatories, over 300,000 came in during the last 72 hours of the talks. People do care. Meanwhile, as we famously know, Al Gore spoke for the rest of Americans who do care about climate change. In the wake of Katrina, wildfires, and strange wind and ice storms, Americans don't support Bush on climate either.
I am not an official of the United States, and I am not bound by the diplomatic niceties. So, I am going to speak an inconvenient truth. My own country, the United States, is principally responsible for obstructing progress here in Bali. We all know that. We all know that. But my country is not the only one that can take steps to ensure that we move forward from Bali with progress and with hope.
So did these gathered dignitaries achieve anything? All governments promised to meet again to form a new successor to the Kyoto Treaty. This new international instrument to be drawn up by 2009 and implemented, we don't know when, will call for deep cuts to climate emissions. Unless we see a fundamental change of heart in a new American administration, right at the 2009 deadline year, all this would be voluntary. The same fuzzy scheme which has allowed us to double and keep doubling the growth of our greenhouse gas emissions. The conference agreed that developing nations could be paid to preserve the last tropical forests in exchange for carbon credits. If you don't cut down your forests, we'll feel better about using coal to power Las Vegas and Disneyland. That was one of the deals. A group of major international corporations may be setting up a carbon market to make enormous profits out of the climate crisis. That is supposed to save the atmosphere in some distant future using the allegedly free market. As Stephen Leahy of IPS News Service reports, there were a couple of bright spots. The Dutch finally agreed to, quote, stop subsidizing oil palm for use as biodiesel, and Germany announced it would cut its emissions by 40% by 2020. Good for Germany if they can do it. The Western countries have agreed to talk about transferring cleaner energy to the developing world. Every week or so, a new coal-fired power plant opens in China. That generating plant will burn 3 times the coal required by an American plant for the same amount of electricity. Why? Because although better burning technology is well known, the intellectual property is being held back. The world burns because we will not share our know-how. Many nations at the conference called for a transfer of green technology. There was agreement, but nothing firm came out of it yet. Humans just don't get it. Mansions and wealth will not survive a final fight out and forced migration toward the poles. Meanwhile, the rest of us plan flights to holiday destinations, drive around for the fun of it, and piss away the whole supply of fossil fuels. Why leave anything for the kids? We'll all be dead then anyway, right? According to the World Meteorological Organization, the decade of 1998 to 2007 was the warmest on record. In Britain, the Hadley Center and the University of East Anglia reported that the top 11 warmest years occurred in the last 13 years. Millions of people are already suffering from climate change. a flurry of press releases from groups like the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization warn that global warming will hit the poorest developing nations the hardest. Africa is already suffering. Is it possible that the world will be divided into the haves and the dying? Is this the coming cull, the mass murder by climate change, the climacost? Will we allow this? That would be the result, say many of our best scientists, if the world follows the sleepy path of American business and its last renegade allies. That is what happens if we all go on slurping carbon and dumping our exhaust into the fragile skies. 2009 seems to loom like a final deadline. Can we motivate enough millions of people, change enough politics and lives to save the world as we know it? 2 years to doomsday decisions. Please, out of compassion for the future, turn off the television and spend that time in action. Go ahead, become a climate fanatic. The future needs you now. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.